Welcome to Delmarva Radio Theater. I'm your host, Harold Wilson. This is a special double feature night on Delmarva Radio Theater. We're presenting two short dramas, The Dark Ride and Call Again. Both radio plays are based on two pulp fiction short stories of the same names, published in Beach Pulp, a publication of Nancy Sakadusky's Cat and Mouse Press. Pulp fiction was a term used to describe a body of writing published on cheap, low-quality paper, thus the name pulp, in the early 1900s. These 10-cent magazines featuring larger-than-life heroes, exotic places, and strange, mysterious characters also came to include Gothic literature, as well as the noir work of writers such as Raymond Chandler and Dashiell Hammett. The Dark Ride, our first drama, is a wonderful macabre horror story with a contemporary psychological twist. Written by Linda Chambers, it's set in the Gothic world of Funland, the haunted mansion on the boardwalk in Rehoboth Beach, Delaware. Dennis Lawson's Call Again is a noir crime story in the gangster style of the 1930s, even though it has a present-day setting. Still, it makes one think of the shady Humphrey Bogart in The Maltese Falcon. So get out the popcorn, settle back, and enjoy an evening of pulp drama on Delmarva Radio Theater. And now, the curtain is drawn back on The Dark Ride.
When I was 19, I spent the summer working a pier in one of the beach towns in the lower section of the Jersey Shore. A real carny type of town. Never mind which one, nothing to look at now. Hurricane Sandy took out most of it. Sometimes I'd be in a booth, sometimes I'd work a ride. In the beginning, I divided my walks home evenly between the streets and the beach itself. Either option provided time to have quiet conversations with friends who were on their way home as well. The boardwalk? Way too wicked and crazed, even by the time I got off work. I was there to stockpile cash for college, not spend it on beer and weed. The following year, I got a job in OC, Ocean City, Maryland, at the Candy Kitchen, Atlantic Avenue, and the Boardwalk. I was of age, so they put me on the night shift where I could close out. I liked the night. Back then, the action was all at this end of town. The block upon block of high-rises you see now were just holes in the ground, foundations, a portent of things to come. The main amusement pier faced the Candy Kitchen, and what I hadn't considered was the crowd pouring off the pier at closing time. Young, wild, drunk. That was a challenge, so I handed in my pink uniform and the little white apron and went back to the pier. Better to watch them stagger away than toward me. Since I had experience from the summer before, I moved quickly from spinning the wheel to shooting the ducks to tossing the ring to grappling with giant stuffed animals. Problem was, I still liked the partying a little too much. I wound up with a lot of hazy memories and not much more. The following year, I reevaluated. I'd partied my way through Jersey and Maryland, so now it was time to visit Delaware. I decided on Rehoboth Beach. Nice town. It's the kind of place you might visit and think about settling down in. I thought about getting a job at Candy Kitchen, as I'd already done that, and my boss in OC had liked me. I considered Grotto Pizza and the waitress thing. I thought about bartending, a lot of money in that. I thought about applying to one of those fancier stores off the boardwalk. There was a bookstore, too, which looked nice. But I like excitement. You can take the girl out of the carnival, but you can't take the carny out of the girl. I like the whooshing sound of cars rocketing around a track and the screams of terror and glee. I like the game booths and the workers enticing the passerbys to take a chance, spin the wheel, hit the target. I like the smells of cotton candy, peanuts roasting, pizza, boardwalk fries heavy with vinegar, fudge, and popcorn. I like the glow of neon as the sunset growing gradually brighter and brighter, pulsating in the night sky as darkness fell. Like I said, even back then I liked the dark. So I got a job at Funland, a boardwalk amusement park and arcade with children's attractions and thrill rides. Compared to the excesses I'd experienced the summers previous, Funland was going to be a breeze. There was an outdoor section off the boardwalk with bigger rides and an indoor section that was great when it rained. There were bumper cars and skee ball, whack-a-mole and pinball machines, arcade games and booths. This was also where you found the dark ride. It was, is, called the Haunted Mansion. Night shift during the week usually had two workers. Sam, my shift partner, and I took turns handling the various jobs. We helped the folks get in their seats, which were suspended from the ceiling and moved on a sort of cable car track. We strapped them in, gave them instructions, made sure everything was secure, and then cranked the lever that started them on their way. If a car stalled, which was rare, the ride was pretty new then, we were responsible for going inside the tunnel, pushing past the hanging skeletons, the swooping vampire bats, and the hands and heads that projected from the sides of the walls, stepping over the coffins that opened and tilted their contents up for display, remembering to hold our ears when we passed the loudspeakers, and getting things going again. There were some genuinely scary moments during the ride, and it was also our responsibility to go in and help any passengers that got so frightened they tried to get out of the car. It was a late July, a night like any other, because that's how they always start. This time, there was a child's cry from inside and then a man's voice shouting,
"Stop the ride! Stop the ride!"
Sam and I looked at each other and did a quick rock, paper, scissors, which I lost. He pulled the emergency lever down.
"Take it easy, everyone. Those of you in line, be patient. It won't be a moment."
I switched on my flashlight and went inside along the edge of the dark, winding tunnel. There were three teens in the car several yards behind the one I needed to get to. They'd already pissed me off when they clambered into the chair at the entrance, overly boisterous, shoving each other and laughing too loud. "It's all right, sir. Don't worry. I'm coming. Please, we'll be moving in a moment. Just stay calm."
Come on, this isn't even scary.
I ignored them and continued shining my light ahead. Now I could see that the problem was a little girl. She'd been very excited as I'd seated her and her dad at the beginning, and now apparently had too much of a fright. It happens. Usually, though, the child is cringing and wailing in the seat. This child had managed to wriggle out of her seatbelt and the seat itself, because she was out of the car, standing on the platform at the edge of the track. She was still, transfixed, staring off into the darkness. Her dad, on the other hand, was wildly cursing at his own seatbelt, and the car was swinging as he struggled to get out. "You just stay there, sir. I'll handle this. Nothing to worry about." More sounds from the car behind. I could hear the car creaking. "Don't move, please," I snapped back at them. "Come on, honey, there's a good girl. Don't move now. The ghosts are scary, but they're not going to hurt you. Nothing to be afraid of."
"It has a face, over there. I saw in the darkness."
"Oh, it's a stupid face. It's really silly if you look close enough at it."
No, that one. It wasn't that one.
Come on, this isn't even scary.
Get this thing moving.
The panicked father of the little girl was still trying to unbuckle his seatbelt. He was now less concerned about his daughter and more focused on taking a fist to the boys behind him. Sir, please, it's all right. Just ignore the boys. This is your daughter? Listen, honey, if you get back in the seat with your dad, I'll tell you what I'll do. You come back later, and I'll take you behind the wall and show you how stupid the ghost is. This intrigued her. I looked at her dad, eyebrow raised. It will be late, I mouthed. He nodded and looked relieved.
Thank you. Thank you. Here, Nancy, get back in the seat.
Hold on, everyone. Here we go. Let her go, Sam. The ride jerked to a start. As the second car passed me, I trotted along beside it, shone the light directly into the boy's eyes. That little girl was scared. If her dad doesn't beat the crap out of you when you get out, I'll find someone who will. As the cars disappeared around the curve, it struck me that the little girl hadn't seemed all that frightened. Dad and daughter appeared as we were shutting down for the night. I could see her more clearly now, red hair and freckles and bright blue eyes. She was wearing one of those matching short and shirt ensembles, very popular at that time. Blue top and red shorts, both splattered with tiny white stars and fishes. Dad had a medium-sized teddy bear tucked under his arm.
I thought she'd forget. Go ahead, honey. You said you wanted to.
Can we go in now?
Sure. Sam, I'll finish inside. You close out if you don't mind.
My wife is going to kill me when she hears about this.
The generator lights were on in the tunnel. I held up my hand. Nancy looked at it disdainfully. Oh, yes, you are, young lady. Take my hand or we don't go in. We trudged through the tunnel until Nancy stopped.
Here, this is where I saw it.
Okay, hold the flashlight. She obeyed. There was a trigger on the track that engaged the ghost dummy. I stamped my foot down on it with enough force to part the folds of the black curtain and propel the dummy forward. I flung my arms around it and pulled it into the light so she could see its white painted face, black holes for eyes, and plastic skeleton hands. As I dragged it forward, dust billowed up my nose, and I sneezed. One of its fingers brushed painfully across my cheek. Here you go, Nancy. Phew, this thing is heavier than I expected. See? Nothing to be afraid of. The beam of the flashlight wasn't on the dummy. It was bouncing off the curtains. It landed on the opening and back behind them. There were numerous openings throughout the ride. They led to a narrow walkway so workers could access mechanisms that operated the displays. Nancy?
It wasn't that one. Look at the opening in the curtain. It was there. Come on, let's go see.
Whoa! Hang on there, Nancy. I eased the dummy back against the wall and turned to her. This is the only one, honey. This is what you saw.
No, it wasn't. It was something else.
I swear, Nancy, this is the only one.
No! It had a face. There was a face.
There's nothing else back there.
Nancy, let's go.
On our way. Let's go. She shifted her gaze from the opening to me. In the generator's half light, her eyes were luminous. She tilted her head to one side and studied me briefly before slowly nodding her head. She was giving in as children usually do because they have to. She was bowing to the stronger of us, to me, the grown-up, and to her father's command from outside. Yet it was absolutely clear to me that I was the one who was wrong, and she'd made the adult decision to simply let it go. She knew the truth, not me. It was as though she'd made the whole argument in her head, and knowing she would never be able to convince me of it, she simply gave up trying.
Okay, here's the flashlight. Oh, your cheek's bleeding.
She turned and trotted toward the entrance. I turned too and looked back at the curtain. Most of it had fallen over the opening in the wall. I lifted my arm and stretched out my hand to pull it aside. The hand flashed out of the darkness, its pale skin white against my deep summer tan. The fingers that curled round my wrist were slender and beautifully shaped, but strong. So strong. What?
You good in there?
Sam, I... The hand that encircled my wrist drew me through the curtain. He was taller than me. I had to look up. Now I understood what Nancy had seen, what had beckoned her forward. His eyes were gray, Those eyes locked me to him. I couldn't look away. He took hold of my chin and tilted my head to one side. He leaned forward and pressed his lips against my cheek, kissing it languidly, leisurely. His mouth drifted down my cheek to my throat. Something cold and sharp brushed my flesh.
Your cheek's bleeding.
I heard Sam again, but he was miles away. The few yards that separated the outside of the ride from its dark center stretched all the way to the ocean, and what must have been an impatient shout was barely a whisper.
You good?
He lifted his head. His eyes were as luminous as Nancy's. I thought of my life. I thought of home. I thought of school and the plans I'd made. I couldn't remember exactly what they were. Yes. Yes, I'm good. I'm...
Okay. See you tomorrow. Don't forget the lights.
We were still staring at each other. I thought I saw a question. Maybe I did. Maybe I didn't. In any case, I answered it. I want the dark ride. And I arched my neck. He obliged. That was well over 40 years ago. At several points during our lifetime together, I would insist he tell me whether he had, in fact, given me a choice. He always said he had. Had I said no, he assured me he would have moved on. We parted on the eve of the millennium. I caught glimpses of him since then, but we've traveled different roads. He was already many years older than me and had seen so much. I think he was waiting for me, though. I returned to Rehoboth 2 years ago. I won't tell you exactly where, not that it matters. For 40 years, I've considered it my hometown, the place I always thought of when far away. This is where I was born in the truest sense of the word. I always knew I'd go back, the way people do after so much time away. It's early August, so I pass a lot of vacationers as I walk the boards. On a beautiful night like this, there are crowds, but I don't mind crowds. I have a drink outside at the Borwick Plaza Hotel. The ocean is noisy and the moon ripples across the waves. When I finish, I go down to the beach and walk all the way to Funland. I stand at the edge of the boardwalk and peer across it, across the noise and the laughter, the shouts and giggles, into Funland itself. I am drinking it in. It makes me happy. Something shifts. Something filters through. My senses are far beyond yours. What you might feel standing next to someone, I feel from yards and yards away. This starts as a tingle on my skin, something cold that wriggles across my arm. Then a sound comes through. I cross the boardwalk. Now I'm inside Funland. I swim through the crowd. The Haunted Mansion has a long line in front of it, but I'm not here for the ride. Whatever is drawing me closer is level with the ride itself. I'm tracking it from where I stand. One ride is ending, more shouts and laughter as a family disembarks. The feeling is very strong now, and I step closer. There's a little girl with red hair struggling with her seatbelt. She's impatient to get out. A middle-aged woman already on the platform is helping her with it. Once free, the child pushes off, and the woman catches her, lifts her, hugs her close, and whirls her around. They are facing me now. The child is struggling. The woman is laughing.
Oh, Grandma, please!
The little girl finally wriggles free and runs off the platform as the woman straightens up, her face still luminous with love. 40-odd years ago, she was much like her grandchild. Even now, I can see in her face happiness, good things, and adventure, her still bright blue eyes reflecting life well lived. There is more gray than red in her hair, but it is thick and long, pulled back in a careless ponytail. I, on the other hand, look exactly the same as I had the night I pulled her back from the curtain nearly a half century ago. Someone close by says, "Nancy." She doesn't move. I don't need to hear her name. I recognize her. The shock is, she recognizes me. She freezes, and so do I. It's been many years since I felt fear, but I feel it now. This life I've carefully constructed is built on a series of slender threads. It works because I'm never in one place for long. No one knows me. I have several options, and I flip through them as I watch her emotions sweep across her face. A man is beside her now, holding the little girl's hand, Nancy's husband. He touches her shoulder, and she gasps. Then she smiles at him. They begin to move past me. She pauses and lets him walk ahead. Then she looks at me.
You saved my life.
I wait until she is swallowed up by the crowd, and then I move in the opposite direction, out of Funland, to the boardwalk, to the beach. The moonlight is shifting across the waves, and I am pondering a new thought. He always swore he gave me a choice. I believed him. He said, had you said no, I would have moved on. But he was hungry. I know all about that hunger. I believe this is the answer to the question I never asked. Had you said no, I would have taken the child.
Well, okay. Time to pull ourselves together, shift gears, and get ready for our next drama, Call Again. But before we do, we're fortunate to have Lena Balestri with us. Lena played the part of Nancy in The Dark Ride. You did a great job, Lena. Let me ask you, what year are you in school?
I'm going into 7th grade next year.
What's your favorite subject?
Out of my core classes, my favorite is science.
What kind of science? Any particular? Chemistry, physics, mathematics?
I just like all science.
Well, what made you want to start acting? You're a very good actress now.
Thank you. What made me first want to start acting was when I was in 3rd grade, my sister did a show at Clear Space, and I just thought it was cool, so I wanted to start too.
So what did you start in? What play or drama did you begin? What was your first?
Well, my first show, I was kind of doing two at the same time. They were Beauty and the Beast and Meet Me in St. Louis. I was Chip in Beauty and the Beast and Tootie in Meet Me in St. Louis.
Did you sing in
Yes.
Meet Me in St. Louis? So you can sing
mm-hmm.
as well.
Yeah.
Oh, excellent. How old were you then? When did you start?
I started doing classes at Clear Space when I was 7, and I did my first show when I was 8.
Tell me about Clear Space. You say you started taking classes at Clear Space. Well, what is Clear Space? I know that it is in Rehoboth Beach. What is Clear Space, and how did you become associated with Clear Space Theater?
Clear Space is a semi-professional theater. And I started because my sister was doing stuff, and I really wanted to try it out. So I started, and I started doing shows. And in the fall, they are doing James and the Giant Peach with a young company. So it's just teenagers and kids, and I'll be playing James.
You will be playing. So that's coming up.
Yes.
Yeah, you're not. I noticed that Hello, Dolly is playing now.
Yes.
And are you in that?
No, I am not.
No room for seventh graders.
No.
In Hello, Dolly. Do you have a favorite role that you've played?
My favorite role that I've played was probably Tootie and Meet Me in St. Louis, just because it was my first role I've ever played, and I just had a lot of fun with it.
What kind of singing did you do? What songs did you sing?
Well, I sang in a lot of songs, but I sang this one really funny song that it was just really funny, and it was my favorite part about the show, and it was just really fun.
So you really enjoyed that, singing that song. Are you going to continue acting as you get older? You're not going to become a soccer professional and give up acting or something like that, are you?
No, because I just really like acting. It's really fun. I just feel really nice when I'm doing it. And I hope when I'm an adult to be professional and do equity and go to college for it.
Wow, that's terrific. You know, in The Dark Ride that we just did, and you played the part of Nancy, the man who played your father had a major in college in acting and at Notre Dame. And then he went on to become a doctor. So he is now both a doctor and an actor.
That's neat.
Does that sound like something that would appeal to you?
I just want to be an actor. There's nothing I've ever really shown another interest in other than acting. It just feels so right to do for me.
That's wonderful. How do you feel when you're playing the part of someone else?
I feel like it's just really interesting because I feel like I'm going into someone else's life and living it for them, and it just feels really cool and fun to do.
No, that's great. Well, tonight you played the role of Nancy. Actually, you did two parts. You did Nancy as a little girl in the funhouse, and then you did Nancy, the young girl, much, much later on, 40 years later. As we've heard, the Dark Ride is kind of a scary play. How did you feel playing the part of someone in this vampire drama?
I thought it was really cool because it was something I've never done before, because I usually do like happy plays and musicals, but this was just such a different experience that I thought it was a good thing to have, and I really liked it.
Well, you were wonderful, Lena. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you again very, very much. And now, get a drink, replenish the popcorn, and shift gears for a lighter 1930s tempo, and listen to our gangster drama, Call Again.
I prefer to work alone, but that wouldn't wash in Bethany Beach. As one of Delaware's quiet beaches, Bethany is full of families, romantic partners, and groups of friends escaping their spouses. A guy like me, 40-something with permanent 6 o'clock shadow, pasty skin, and a receding hairline, with no family to account for the hair loss, would stick out and arouse suspicion. I had a job to do that night, and the only way I could do that job was to blend into the crowd like an everyman, which was why I brought Holly, one of my associates from the organization. Holly, a 40-something herself, is much better preserved and will nicely draw attention away from me. We're sitting on the second-floor deck of the Ropewalk restaurant, looking at the people going in and out of shops on Garfield or making their way to or from the beach. It's not quite noon, and the lunch crowd is sparse. I close my menu. I know it's a little early for a whiskey sunset, Holly, but I'm going to have one anyway. Holly lowers her menu just enough to look at me through her sunglasses. She has long, lush, silver blonde hair that curls at the end.
Tisk, tisk, Dick. You know my rule.
What rule is that, sweetheart?
I don't know, darling, but doesn't that sound like something a wife would say? I get paid to have torrid affairs all the time. If I'm going to cover for you on this supposed vacation, I want to be married.
This meant I had to borrow wedding rings plus an engagement ring from a pawnbroker I know. I couldn't wait to get this gold band off my finger. Holly, she seemed to be enjoying her rings too much. I know she's not giving them back.
What are you getting to eat?
The burger.
Get an appetizer, too.
An appetizer why?
Because I'm getting mozzarella sticks, and I'm going to eat them all. And I don't want to look like a pig. Now listen to your wife.
She's wearing a black knee-length cover-up that's roomy enough to be decent over a two-piece red swimsuit and well-fed curves, along with thin cork sandals that have a bit of a lift in the heel. I'm also dressed casually. T-shirt, cargo shorts, and old sneakers. We had gone to the beach earlier that morning, and while I walked the shoreline, Holly worked on her tan. I think all that sun exposure did something to your brain, Holly. It's not good for you.
Isn't that a shame? Things that are fun are so rarely good for you.
But you don't worry?
Darling, worrying would give me wrinkles.
While Holly and I are eating, a lady who was sitting alone caught my eye. She was farther inside, away from the deck, even though there were still plenty of tables near us. Apparently, the view didn't matter. She's blonde, in her 30s, pretty, with more makeup than she needs, a tight white dress and sandals. Under her table is a beach bag filled to the brim. A towel bulged out on top. Her glass of water was untouched. Her menu was closed, but none of the waiters seemed to be in a hurry to go to her. Her lips, red and aggressive, were pressed together in an angry expression.
Checking out the other merchandise, darling?
We're working, remember? What do you make of her?
Look at that expression. She's waiting to meet someone she doesn't care for. I know, darling. I've only been in that position a million times or so before.
As if on cue, a man emerges from the stairs and crosses the room toward the blonde. The man is in his 60s with a ring of gray hair around his head and a beige fedora on top. He's in a red Hawaiian shirt, khaki shorts above the knees, boat shoes, and he's carrying a new beach bag matching the one under the blonde's table. I know this man. He's Ned Grandin, and I know him because I'm supposed to lean on him tonight, and it could get worse. Okay, I'm an enforcer for the organization, and Grandin is my mark for the night. I had a solid report on his typical day-to-day activities. The rope walk was his usual lunch spot, but not today. What was he doing here? Grandin sits down and slides his bag next to the blonde's. They have a brief, seemingly unpleasant conversation. Then the blonde lifts Grandin's bag and walks away.
Hey, stick around, sweetie. Might have some fun.
The white dress doesn't answer and doesn't look back.
Do you know anything about this, Dick? Is she part of the game?
Maybe. I don't know. But she could complicate things. I'm guessing he's collecting some money to try and save his skin. Nothing to do with us.
I think we should help her.
Don't worry, sweetheart. He's not going to be a problem for her or anyone else after tonight.
But you'll have a loose end. A loose end in a white dress.
I admit I was curious. And Holly didn't look like she'd take no for an answer. Take your purse and Taylor. Make like you're heading for the ladies' room. Holly pulls her small purse out of the canvas beach bag under our table. Beside our beach stuff, the bag held my Glock 26 with a small suppressor based on an old military design. There was also a burner phone with another one in her purse.
I know what I'm doing.
She stands up, puts on her black straw hat, and gives my cheek two gentle slaps.
You still owe me a dessert.
I signal the waiter and pay the check. I'd been drinking cola with my burger, with occasional sips of the generously tall whiskey sunset. I still had half the whiskey concoction left. I take a final sip, pick up the canvas bag, and with some regret walk away. At the bottom of the stairs to the ground floor, a framed cigar box label featured the face of a brunette with short flapper hair and green eyes. She watches me go. Below her cute but menacing face were red letters that spelled, "Call again." Below that, in smaller letters, it repeated, "Call again." There was something ominous about the message that made me hope I'd live through the day and be able to return. Outside in the bright sunshine on Garfield Avenue, I put on sunglasses and look around the crowds. Holly stands a block away at the corner of Garfield and Atlantic. She gives me a brief wave and I move to join her. A few feet from her is the blonde, now in shades herself, looking at nothing at all. Other people are gathering there, too. It's a trolley stop.
Your head is getting red, Dick. You should have worn a hat.
Ever the wife, aren't you, sweetheart? The trolley pulls up. It's more of a bus now, but the iconic look remains. A bright yellow top half and a sky blue bottom half emblazoned with Bethany Beach in yellow letters. The blonde gets on first and takes a seat in the middle. I follow Holly towards the back. She takes the window seat. The trolley heads north along Atlantic, parallel to the boardwalk and the ocean. The third stop takes us near the Addy Sea, a bed and breakfast in a Victorian house.
That's where we should have stayed, instead of that cheap motel.
Next time, sweetheart. Next time.
Yeah, right. You know I believe that.
The trolley heads west into a residential neighborhood. I'm thinking about Grandin. He seemed pretty cheerful for a guy so far in debt to the organization that he had become a marked man. He was an accountant who was willing to help his clients in any way they could afford. But as his clients met a variety of ends, some pleasant, some less so, he tried to maintain his lifestyle with gambling. That works for some people, but not most. He was lucky he managed to hold on to his beach house. He mainly gambled and lost at the organization's venues. The boss had been willing to float him some money so he could get back on his feet, but at this point, he owed too much for too long. To keep breathing, he needed to pay up now. That was my job, to get the final payment, or to turn him over for the final, final payment. I didn't know who that was, and I didn't want to know. At the next stop, behind a family with kids, a guy about 10 years my junior boards. He makes no effort to blend in. Plaid sport coat over a white-collared shirt, dark blue jeans with a wide brown leather belt and brown loafers. Mirrored shades, and I can only guess at the large caliber of the gun he was sure to have holstered beneath the jacket. Everything about him said New Jersey mob. There was probably a gold watch under there, too. He exuded enough confidence for everyone on the bus to choke on. He sits down beside our blonde friend. I feel much worse for her, and for the first time, I'm glad we'd followed her. Everyone else on the bus was paying attention to their own groups or watching the town go by outside. Holly and I were the only ones reading the tension between the blonde and the schmuck. They exchange a few words. The man leans forward, and I guessed he was rifling around in the blue beach bag. I reach into our bag and take my phone, wallet, a pack of cigarettes, and a lighter. I didn't like leaving the gun behind, but I wasn't planning on doing anything but tailing if this guy got off. He did just that at the next stop, another residential area. I'm going, Holly. You stay on Blondie. The good news is that the guy seemed indifferent to me, even though I'm the only other person getting off. It helped that it was a busy stop. I did some bad acting as I exited the trolley, taking a look at the time on my watch without seeing it and gazing over at the church across the street like it had meaning to me. Then I walk in the direction of the plaid jacket. He was 30 feet ahead of me, but as loud as ever. I don't have to walk far. Mr. Plaid Jacket takes out a pair of keys and ducks into a street-parked blue BMW and speeds away. Jersey plates. New Jersey. I haven't lost the touch. I sit down on the bench and light a cigarette. A text comes in from Holly.
Got off next stop, followed to Off the Hook Restaurant. Meet you there.
And off the hook, Holly is at a table at the other end of the place with a menu and a strawberry milkshake.
So what happened?
You got into a car with Jersey plates and peeled out of here.
What do you want to do?
Some coffee will do for starters. I don't like the fact that Plaid Jacket was willing to go through this little drama to get something from Blondie. I think Grandin sold something valuable to the blonde and then sold the same item to that Plaid Jacket who was willing to rob a woman in public to get it. What's this thing Plaid Jacket has? We need to talk to Blondie. Holly, go see if you can get her to come over here.
I'll get her.
Just a second, Holly. How can we be sure she doesn't end up testifying against me?
Leave it to me, lover.
Holly crosses the restaurant and joins the blonde at the bar. Less than 2 minutes later, the two of them join me at our table. The blonde is crying softly.
Dick, this is Kimberly. She understands that she's going to forget everything about us and what we say, and we're going to forget everything about her. But we're going to help each other out, because Grandin has to be stopped.
Why not? My life is over anyway.
Whatever Grandin gave you, what the man in the plaid jacket took from you, I intend to return to you. Just level with me, and after I give it back, forget me. That's all I ask.
Why are you helping me?
Because Grandin is worthless scum, and because my friend here asked me to. Kimberly puts her hands over her face and pulls herself together. She takes a deep breath.
It's like this. I used to live a different kind of life. When I was 22, I was Grandin's mistress. I can't tell you the sorts of things I did back then. But I turned my life around. I'm married now. I have two kids. I'm a teacher, and my husband has no idea what I used to be.
Listen, honey, there's never a need to apologize to a man for the life you led before you knew him.
It sounds so easy, but I don't want him to know. So anyway, he grew up loving Bethany Beach. We come here for 2 weeks every summer. I knew Ned was around. One time, he gave me a leer and a wicked smile, but otherwise, it's been fine. The only problem is that back then, he took pictures of me doing some things. I always hoped he would move on to other girls and didn't care about those old pictures. But then, out of the blue, he calls me up at our rental. He tells me he'll sell me the pictures along with the negatives for $5,000, or he'll show them to my husband for free. Now I'm out $5,000 and someone else has the pictures.
But why would this someone else want them?
I have no idea. Oh, sorry.
Did he get all the pictures?
No, I was looking at them when he came over on the bus and pointed his gun at me. You know, I wanted to make sure Ned had really coughed them up. I realized after the guy on the bus was gone that one had fallen on the floor. This one isn't anything explicit. A bunch of lowlives were partying at the Hotel DuPont one night. Ned had his camera.
The first thing I noted about the dark photo was the date printed in orange, June 21st, 1999. The next thing I saw was Kimberly in the foreground, holding a drink and looking as devilish as anyone I'd ever known. I looked up at her just to make sure it was really the same person. It was. And then I noticed in the background, a little blurry but still clearly recognizable, my boss, 20 years younger but still not all that young. It was clear evidence that he was in Wilmington on the night of June 21st, 1999, the night of three murders the local press had dubbed the Summertime Slayings. One was a Delaware mobster and the other two were associates of a criminal organization in New Jersey. There were no good suspects, but the word on the street was that it was Paul Cartwright, the man who would go on to be my boss. Nothing conclusive. He had plenty of witnesses to say he was at the beach at the time. Now there was this photo. Kimberly, are there more shots of this party?
A few, yes.
We need those photos. Do you know anything about the guy in the plaid sport coat?
I've never seen him before.
I closed my eyes and leaned back. Leave your number with Holly and go home. We'll give you a call when we get the photos.
How do I contact you?
You don't. Ned Grandin had a small but nicely maintained one-story house on Delaware Court. Trees and bushes along the driveway and around the house gave him some privacy. It wasn't far from the restaurant, We cross the street to the Bethany Diner on the corner of Garfield and Half Moon Drive. We follow Half Moon down a few residential blocks, and there was the woodsy Delaware Court. I hung back while Holly walked up the driveway, beach bag in tow. All I had in my pocket now was my Glock with the mini suppressor already attached. It was small enough to fit in my cargo shorts pocket. Holly rang the doorbell. The plan was for her to explain to Grandin that she was a thank-you gift from the New Jersey fellas for cutting them in on the pictures deal. According to our recon, Grandin took his dinner at Mango's, a great restaurant that overlooks the beach. He used to throw his money around to pick up ladies. Lately, he had been relying on his charm and striking out. So the odds were good that he would believe any story Holly laid on him. The door opened, and Holly talked her way in. A couple of minutes later, I entered onto soft white carpeting in a lush living room. Black leather couches, large screen TV mounted on the wall, bright abstract painting from the 90s, a variety of plants, and a portable chrome bar where Grandin was fixing two drinks. Things are certainly going your way today, aren't they, Grandin? Grandin turns around, crystal bottle in hand.
And who the hell are you?
I'm here on the matter of your gambling debt to the organization.
I'm in one of their spots practically every day of the week, and they send a goon to my house like this? I'm insulted. I'll be in tonight and I'll have plenty of cash with me. We can chat then. For now, how about you go catch a wave?
I sit down on the couch. I hadn't pulled my gun out because I thought Grandin would talk more if he felt like he was in a position to negotiate. I'm also confident that if he had a gun anywhere nearby, I was still faster. I saw the girl come in, Grandin, and I'm guessing you want me out of here as quickly as possible. Let me give it to you straight. We know you cut a deal with the New Jersey crew. We want them more than we want you. Tell me who the man in the plaid jacket is and where he's off to, and I'll be on my way.
I don't know what you're talking about.
I'm not going to wait all day, Grandin. I didn't envy him. It wasn't an easy choice.
No more debt?
What's that?
I'll tell you everything, but I want my slate wiped clean.
I sat back and acted like I had to think about it. That's a tall order. While Grandin had himself another pull of whiskey, the front door swung open. It was Mr. Plaid Jacket.
Yeah, I knew something was up.
Grandin spit out some of his whiskey in surprise, right on that nice white carpet.
I told you not to come here.
Shut up, old man. Your setup was too weird. I hung around to see if my suspicions were right. Sure enough, two jokers from old man Cartwright's crew come walking in here.
I don't know what you're talking about. The girl was booked to come here. I'm the cashier.
Do I look like an idiot? I know you're an enforcer for Cartwright.
He pulled a gun out from under his jacket and casually pointed it at me.
I'm pretty curious. Why he's on your couch, Grandin? And you're not full of slugs.
What's taking so long? I'm still waiting for my drink.
Then she walks in. Stark naked, she leans her arm on the wall.
Who the hell are you, Mr. Plaid Jacket?
His mouth was still falling open as I drew my gun and fired two quick shots into his chest. I dove to the floor and got him twice more. Once high in the chest and one in the head. He didn't manage to get a single shot off. Grandin backed away from the body and into the wall. He was shaking, so I guided him over to the couch and sat him down.
I need my heart medicine. It's in the bedroom.
I saw it. Just a minute.
She left and came back with a glass of water in one hand and pills in the other.
Open up, sweetie.
She jams the pills into his mouth, brings the glass to his lips, and he drinks. She got the whiskey, but Grandin shook his head no. She lightly slaps his cheek and forces the booze on him.
Grow up, big guy.
He takes a few swallows and lets out a hacking cough.
God, you know it's funny. All these years, I had no idea what I had. I have lots of pictures of girlfriends. Kim, she just happened to be someone who was nearby and had the means to be blackmailed. When I dug up those old photos, I couldn't believe it when I saw Cartwright in them. I didn't even know who he was back then. It felt like a gold mine. I could touch Kim for some easy cash. And then I figured the New Jersey guys would love to take Cartwright down. They could give him photos. They could give the photos to the police, leak them to the press, kill him themselves for all that. But the way things worked out, you saved my skin as much as you saved your own. You named the price. It's yours.
His speech is now taking some effort. He lay down on the couch. Why go through the trouble of including Kimberly?
You guys think you're smart. I think I noticed someone tailing me a couple of times. I figured I was under surveillance. No way did I want to be seen with someone from another.
He trails off and is asleep. What'd you give him, Holly?
His heart medicine. Maybe a little more than the recommended dose. The thing is, it has nitroglycerin in it, and you can't mix that with the little blue pills that a lot of my customers use. So it's unfortunate that he had one of those, too.
What's going to happen?
He'll go into cardiac arrest pretty soon. I'm going to get dressed.
Cardiac arrest? Jesus, you've killed him, Holly? I'm negotiating with him about his payment and the New Jersey guys, and you kill him?
Just doing my job, Dick. You don't think I was sent with you just for cover, do you? His time was up and the association knew you wouldn't kill him. That's not your thing. That was my job. The final, final payment. Now help me carry his body to his bed. I saw the $5,000 on his bureau. We'll get that, too. The New Jersey guy? Just leave him on the floor. I'll call Cartwright and they'll send guys over to clean up the mess here and dispose of Plaid Jacket, as well as his car, after we get the pictures.
Holly?
Just move it, Dick. This is my show now.
The blue BMW is up the street. We find Kimberly's pictures and negatives crammed under the passenger seat. We're back in the motel room now, and Holly makes the calls. Kimberly makes an excuse to her family and drops in to watch us burn the photos, since we obviously couldn't just return them. She didn't ask for the $5,000 back, which was good, since I knew the boss would want it. Holly calls the boss and tells him about the day's work. Her show now. I'm cut out. Where does all this leave me? I'm going to the rope walk for another whiskey sunset, Holly. Come along if you want. She's on the bed, wearing her black cover-up and watching television.
I have an appointment tonight, lover boy. Sorry.
You're working?
I can fit you in, if you can match my price.
You know I can't afford you, especially since I'm splitting my payment for this job with you.
No need for that. I'm getting paid on my own for this little action. Let's go. My treat.
I thought you had an appointment?
Didn't you hear, lover? I'm on vacation.
I hope you enjoyed our dramas. This pulp fiction genre certainly strikes a chord, and I believe it will always be with us. And now, a great thanks to our cast. The Dark Ride featured Nancy Sherman as the narrator, Chris Rank as Sam, Mike Murphy as the father, Lena Balestri as Nancy the child, and Judy Reveal as Nancy the grandmother. In Call Again, our thanks to Mike Murphy, doing double duty as Dick, Judy Hearn as the deadly Holly, Judy Reveal, again doing double duty, as Kimberly in the tight white dress, and Jim King as Mr. Plaid Jacket. Your host was Ned Grandin. Many of our cast members are members of the Community Players of Salisbury, and we offer a special thanks to Lena Balestri and Clear Space Theater in Rehoboth Beach. Delmarva Radio Theater is a production of Delmarva Public Radio. Thanks to all of you for listening. I'm your host, Harold Wilson. Let's take it away now with a little more Golden Leaf Strut.